Any questions or comments? Minutes before.
Oh, I have a question really quick.
Yeah.
It goes back to the transcendental aesthetic, though.
Yeah.
Or maybe even the introduction. He says that the aesthetic is an idea. He just calls it an idea. Like the entire thing is just an idea. What exactly does that mean?
You're saying the transcendental aesthetic itself is an idea.
Yeah. Remember when he's talking about it's not going to be the complete science.
Yeah.
I can find the passage if you.
I mean, he does speak about, you know, the particular reason not giving us the complete science. Let's say metaphysics in its entirety. Or even transcendental philosophy in its entirety. There's certain things that are not going to be worked out
right.
Completely. That's part of this. Where is it?
I'm looking for it right now.
I mean, to some degree, your question being asked is to focus on what is the conception that is here being provided about knowing and about experience. Because there is obviously a thinking about what is being put before us. That is not itself the subject of the investigation. And then one thing about the whole investigation of the transcendental aesthetic, which becomes, you know, more and more maybe suspect or confusing, is the extent to which it is presented apart from the discussion of the analytic, that is, of the account of understanding. Because in the deduction, it becomes more and more apparent that sensibility is itself very much mediated by and in fundamental ways determined through what is going on in the discussion and it's presented in the transcendental deduction of the categories.
I found
so
that,
yeah, okay.
He says on page 151 in the second introduction,
yeah.
The critique of pure reason there accordingly belongs everything that constitutes transcendental philosophy, and it is the complete idea of transcendental philosophy,
yeah.
But it's not yet the science itself, since it goes only so far in the analysis as is requisite,
yeah,
for the complete,
yeah,
estimation of synthetic a priori cognition.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, and elsewhere he'll point out what is not included in this critique. And that comprises a full explication of, in a sense, what is presented in a more abstract way here. And where you see that fuller development being presented are in the works that Kant follows the critique of, the critique of the reason with one's what would have, you know, the metaphysical foundations of natural science, where he explicates in greater detail what nature is. It's the same nature that we're dealing with here. That's basically the objectivity that experience addresses. Likewise, there's something else that he adds on, which will be the metaphysics of freedom, where he will explicate in a sense, the concepts of morality and justice, which also are implicit in discussions we will come across here. And he'll suggest that, in a sense, what he's doing there is really explicating what his original intent is. And, you know, that bears upon a basic feature of the kind of investigation he's engaged in. On the one hand, it sets out as being a kind of preliminary that philosophy must engage in order to be able to make valid claims about objectivity by using reason alone. So, right, we're going to be investigating the ability of reason to make such claims. And only when we've subjected reason to scrutiny are we going to get in a position to address what is. But it turns out that the only way in which an investigation of knowing can bear upon the claims of knowing is if the object of knowing is determined by the structure of knowing. Otherwise, our investigation of knowing has no bearing upon the truth of knowing. But if we're not going to make appeal to a given that we have some kind of access to independently of knowing, that's precisely the problem that the critique of reason must address. I mean, not to just dogmatically presume that we can read off the character of the given. Then the only way in which our attempt to investigate the validity of knowing can proceed without illicitly making appeals to the given is if somehow the structure of knowing determines the character of what it can know. But that means this so-called preliminary investigation is really going to end up providing us with what can be known, objectively speaking. We won't have anything left to do except perhaps simply explicating what has been presented here. I think that's what you find happening with Kant. I wanted to begin just by focusing upon the original, pure unity of apperception, also called transcendental unity of apperception. You know, obviously Kant is giving a self-consciousness of a very special kind, a very fundamental role, as something that really provides very much basis for knowledge. Knowledge that ends up being construed as what we know in experience. It might seem that he's doing something similar to Descartes when his meditations ends up reverting to the I that is aware of itself, as being the firm foundation from which one can build to gather knowledge of other things. And as those of you who have read the meditations know, Descartes, through his process of doubt, comes to certainty of the I, while at the same time being doubtful of anything else. So on the one hand, that presents the possibility of there being self-consciousness without consciousness of what is other than the I, that there can be self-consciousness without consciousness of objectivity confronting the I. It also carries with it the idea that self-consciousness involves knowledge of what the I is. Descartes will say that, you know, what I know is that I am a thinking thing. Now, I think if you look carefully at what Kant's doing, neither of these things hold. On the one hand, the apperception or the self-consciousness that here is in a sense necessarily ingredients in any awareness is also necessarily something that involves awareness of something objective. It necessarily involves what could be called experience. It necessarily involves what could be called cognition. And that is also tied up with something else. That the self-consciousness at work here, or the apperception, does not provide knowledge of the I. The I is something that is a thought. And Kant wants to very carefully distinguish thinking from cognizing. The I is a thought. And precisely because of the kind of thought that must accompany all intuitions in order for them to be intuitive, to be something for an awareness, it is not something that itself contains any intuitive content, nor any other content of any sort. It has no manifold. It's rather that which must be able to accompany any manifold for a manifold to be something of which we are aware. Now, cognition, by contrast, is different from simply thinking a content. Cognition requires thinking a content that is known to be objective, or thinking a content that is in some kind of necessary connection to an object, and thereby can qualify something that represents an object in a determinate fashion, whereby it provides knowledge. Now, as you know, for Kant, concepts in and of themselves do not have direct access to objects. They only have a mediated relation to objects. And their mediation to objects is by way of intuitions. Now, nonetheless, Kant has told us that intuitions in and of themselves do not provide a relation to an object. Even if they may, at least a relation to an object that is a determinative one, allows them to really count as representations of an object. Somehow, the concept and connection to them must do something that allows them to represent. And when Kant speaks of what the concept is of an object, he does this in the B deduction in a way similar to how he discussed the concept of the transcendental object X in the following way. On page 249, he says, an object is that in the concept of which the manifold of the given intuition is united. The given intuition by itself does not provide us with the object, but provides us with the object is a uniting of given intuitions through a concept. And it's in that, in virtue of that unification of intuitions through a concept, that we have an object. Now, Kant will also speak of the object as something distinct from thinking. An object in cognizing an object. If you look on page 254, he writes it, paragraph 22, that to think of an object and to cognize an object are not the same. Question is, what's going on in cognition of an object? If you look at the discussion where Kant distinguishes, or I should say, brings in cognition He writes the following. This is right after the remark regarding how an object is that in the concept of which the manifold to be given intuition is united. He writes, all unification of representation requires unity of consciousness in the synthesis of them. Consequently, the unity of consciousness is that which alone constitutes the relations of representations to an object. Thus, their objective validity. So in a sense, the concept which allows for given intuitions to be united so that they provide us with the determination of an object is something very much connected with the same unification provided by the unity of self-consciousness. Now, we've seen this operate in several ways, all right? In the A deduction, there was a notion, of course, that this necessary unification of representations imposed by the unity of self-consciousness, that they must be united so as to fit within self-consciousness, is something that is tantamount to having them ordered by a rule. And to the extent that the ordering in question is necessary, it's tantamount to having them being ordered by a law. And this was connected with the role of the understanding and conceptuality. I mean, why was the ordering of all representations within the unity of self-consciousness something that involved the application of a rule? It can be thought of a rule that, as necessary, is tantamount to have them united in terms of a law that specifies their unity. Why talk of a law? Which, of course, is a rule that is necessary. What is it? Why would the connection, the connectedness, apply to all representations, all intuitions that they're given, and appear to be something imposed upon them from without, be tantamount to having them being ordered by a law? Well, remember, the law is something that does not differentiate between what falls under. Whatever is subject to the law is equal under the law. The law applies to them all, irrespective of their content. And this is the unification that applies to all sensible intuitions, irrespective of what they are. So it's a necessary unification of such a character that's indifferent to their particular content. And that, of course, must be the case because nothing in their particular content has any necessary character, right? Because the content of sensible intuitions is something given in particular experiences, that is, it's particular and contingent. So here we're talking about a unity applying to all that falls under it, that is the same unity, that therefore has something law-like about it or universal about it. And of course, to apprehend a law, you have to think it. You can't imagine it. It involves, in a sense, like a combination that involves a function of combination that is going to be specified by something conceptual. Right? Now, in the B deduction, you have the same necessary application of the unity to all sensible intuitions in order for them to stand under the same awareness and be for consciousness. But now, the combination that is also lawful is qualified as being a function of judgment. And you might ask, well, why bring in judgment? Well, what is the aspect that's tied to judgment that makes the lawfulness of representation is something that here in the deduction is spoken of in terms of judgment?
It's a necessary connection.
Well, there's a necessary connection, but what else does judgment carry with it? A sense of an objective connection. I mean, of course, you can consider a necessary connection as being non-arbitrary. And judgment, in a sense, is that kind of combination, which in contrast to an arbitrary combination, such as a subjective association, as one might do by simply using one's imagination to recall representations and connect them in any order one wants. It's all within one's awareness, so there is a subjective unity of self-consciousness which pertains to whatever contents happen to be in my unitary awareness, but not an objective unity. Well, judgments are those combinations which connect representations in a way that is objective, so that what is being, in a sense, presented is a connection that is not something simply that I make, but something that is inherent in the terms in question. Now, that lawfulness necessarily imposed upon representations in order for them to fit within self-consciousness is something that gives them a necessary connectedness, a non-subjective connectedness, that, as Kant will emphasize, is precisely what is involved in being aware of anything objective. Because what it means to be aware of anything objective is to have representations whose relation to one another is not arbitrary. Only because their relation to one another is not arbitrary can they present anything about something that is non-subjective. We can't go and pick out the content of the object and attempt to correlate it with the content of the representations. Why not? And what does he say? Reason being that we can't. Yeah, we only have these representations. That's all we have. So the only resource that can provide anything objective about them is the form of their relation to one another. That it's non-arbitrary and necessary. Or that it has something lawful about it, or that it has something that is a kind of combination that is what judgment provides. And so, in a sense, the contents of what we are aware of can't fail to be determined through judgment, and thereby through the concept that specifies the function of a judgment. And that concept then will necessarily apply. Now, I say concept right now, I'm not speaking about plurality. Just as I was speaking of law, not a plurality of different laws. Because the argument, as it stands, doesn't really provide on its own, in terms of just the relationship of self-consciousness as something necessary to whatever can be given to knowing. That speaks to objects in general rather than particular objects. It speaks to a necessary connectedness without further qualification. And it speaks to a necessary combination or function, which at one and the same time provides universality and necessity to the connectedness, and objectivity to the connectedness. Now, Kant himself points out that if we wanted to speak about particular laws, we would have to, in a sense, appeal to experience. And if you look on page 264, speaks about this. At the very bottom of 263, he says, "A pure faculty of understanding does not suffice, however, to describe to the appearances through mere categories a priori laws beyond those on which rests a nature in general, as lawfulness of appearances in space and time." No, he says lawfulness. doesn't here speak about particular laws. Particular laws, because they concern empirically determined appearances, cannot be completely derived from the categories, although they stand under them. Experience must be added in order to come to know particular laws at all. And by the way, we'll have to see how this plays out, because if there are such things as empirical laws, one might wonder how they can be derived from experience. What might seem questionable about that? And the necessity, because, you know, throughout, you know, we understand that what can be derived from experience lacks those features of universality and necessity that characterize what is a priori, be it analytic or synthetic. So there's some question about, you know, in what respect there are going to be particular laws. Now, Kant, of course, here invokes a plurality of categories. That there are a plurality of categories was something that he simply put before us in the metaphysical deduction. You know, it's not, which also involve a claim that they're a necessary function of judgment. Now, if you want to invoke a plurality of categories, that's tantamount to invoking, in a certain respect, a plurality of types of lawful connections, or types of necessary combinations as exhibited in the different possible forms of judgment. Now, these are going to be functions that are necessarily determinative of objects in general. What does that tell us about their operation vis-a-vis each and every object? If, remember, we're talking about factors that are involved in thinking an object in general, or that, another way of putting it, are constitutive of experience in general, or, in a way, are the determinate manner by which sensibility is made containable in self-awareness. What would seem to be have to be true about the categories in their plurality?
It seems like they all have to be at work.
Yeah, it would seem
every,
that
in every.
Yeah, it would seem that every object would necessarily be determined or thought by means of all of them together. So that this might give us a way to consider to what degree the specification of categories is just sort of given to us without argument, without even telling us what the categories are, really stands up. Because what we can do is try to examine to what degree the functions of judgment or the functions of necessary combination that each category involves are indispensable for representations providing cognition of any object whatsoever. Now, the argument in the transcendental deduction doesn't get into those differentiations. It just speaks about the general connectedness of how the necessary unification imposed by pure self-consciousness, that is, it's necessarily universally ingredient in any awareness, figures as transcendental because that unification is precisely what allows those connected contents to be something non-subjective, to thereby be able to represent an object, or maybe more generally, objectivity or nature, and to do so in a way that is determinative of it. So we want to see, somewhere or other, whether when we get the details of what these concepts are and how they operate, they are indeed determinative of each and every object. Because that, in a sense, is presumed here by the nature of the argument. And when Kant speaks about the thoroughgoing unity that self-consciousness has. Once more, that thoroughgoingness is going to be, in a sense, connected to the way in which all of the different forms of judgment as expressed in the categories that represent those forms of connection play a constituent role in determining objectivity. So that the lawfulness of nature now will have a manifold, thoroughgoing character. Now, regarding that thoroughgoing character, I think it still remains apparent in the nature of the argument that that thoroughgoing ordering of sensible intuition cannot lay hold of what is contingent in sensible intuition. Why not? And when I say what is contingent sensible intuition, what am I talking about? What is contingent?
Contents of the appearances.
No,
contents
of the sense. The so-called matter, you know, the sensible content of sensation.
Yeah.
In a sense. That is, because it is variable and contingent in particular, none of that content is necessarily ingredient in any object. It's something to be encountered in what Kant might call the subjective unity of awareness, right? At any time, what falls within my awareness will be something that on the one hand involves a necessary lawfulness, which applies to anything objective of which I'm aware, but that lawfulness governs a content whose particular matter has nothing necessary about it. And if it has nothing necessary about it, you want to ask, well, is there a way of carrying over any objectivity to it? Or are we compelled to regard all of that matter, which sensation provides, as merely something subjective? Sort of reintroducing the kind of distinction that both rationalists and empiricists made between, you know, primary and secondary qualities. Where the primary qualities pertaining to what is lawful in matter are what are truly objective, whereas everything pertaining to the sensuous qualities given in particular sensations is merely subjective. That is, it only informs us of at best how our own particular contingent sensibility happens to be affected by something that need not in any way conform or correspond to the content of those sensations. And that's something to think about, given the nature of the argument, that in a sense what counts as objective is only that which has to do with the necessary form that representations have, with their necessary unity or connectedness to one another. Now, the concepts in question that are going to here be, in a sense, legitimated, namely the concepts that give expression to the unities of judgment, that at least in general are going to be at hand simply because they give expression to a necessary combination that must be ingredient in what is for awareness. These concepts are definitely different from the kind of concepts that express functions of unity that apply to particular things or particular representations, right? The kind of empirical concepts that involve picking out a mark found in a plurality of representations, which when you think it, connects them, as well having that mark, as well being united in terms of what we are thinking when we think that common factor, that either they instantiate or under which they might all be subsumed. Any such concept is automatically going to be something that is devoid of any necessity or universality. It's because it draws upon a content that's part of the matter of sensibility. Now that, in a sense, is a key point regarding what has to be addressed if one wants to really think through how the connectedness whose necessity is established by the argument of the transcendental deduction, works itself out. Because what the transcendental deduction presents us with is that there can't be awareness of any sort unless it is subject to a general necessary unification that allows it to fit within self-awareness. But it doesn't quite tell us how that occurs. And there are two sides to the how. One is how it involves specific functions of unification, as characterized by different categories. And then there's the other side of it, how sensibility gets subsumed under these combinations. And there is a kind of problem, because as Kant points out in the opening discussions of the section on the schematism of the pure concepts of the understanding, when we're dealing with the categories, they are necessarily heterogeneous with the content of sensibility. Now, sensible or empirical concepts are not. They are homogeneous with what falls under them. Why is that necessarily the case? And why can it not be the case with categories? Or that is, they necessarily fall under in terms of their own content. Yes?
Well, their general concepts are drawn from a set of contents contained in a set of sensible intuitions.
Yeah, because in a sense, you know, as the empiricists explain the concept of universality, it's something just drawn from something contained in each of the particulars that fall under the universal. The universal is itself a content they share in common. It's in them. But no such content that is in particulars that are experienced can be a content that is genuinely universal and necessary. It's something that happens to hold true of those particular representations, but precisely because it's contingent, whether it need hold true or not, the way it connects them does not afford any objectivity to the representations it connects. By contrast, the categories, which cannot apply to the particular content of sensible intuitions in any direct fashion, instead apply to a unification that holds true of sensible intuitions irrespective of their particular content. So that raises the question, how are they going to fit? How are we going to be able to actually succeed in subsuming the given content of sensible intuitions under the forms of combination that the categories give expression to? Because the categories, as being necessarily ingredient in experience, that is, in all objects, are necessarily heterogeneous with the particular contingent contents of sensible intuitions. So there seems to be a problem here. Because after all, the transcendental deduction at most presents, in a sense, the necessity that there are pure forms of judgment, or there is a lawfulness that the understanding provides as the way in which self-consciousness can be in conjunction with what one is aware of, allowing contents to be contents that one can be aware of. The argument that draws all these connections does not in any way get into the details of what the specific type of combinations are involved, if there are specific types, let alone how those combinations actually get involved with regard to the sensible material. Now, you may remember that in the transcendental deduction, Kant, on the one hand, in the deduction, begins by speaking about all combination being, in a sense, work of understanding. But on the other hand, he does bring in imagination. And does bring in imaginations involving, in a sense, combinations of its own that have a necessary role to the extent that they seem to intercede between what the understanding does, and just thinking of the function of unification, and the way in which it's going to apply to the actual contents of sensible intuitions, to enable them to be so combined. And I think it's worth just keeping in mind sort of what Kant identifies in the deduction as being sort of a key move for the deduction to work. If you look on page 253, where he has a remark, which is section 21, sort of commenting on the previous paragraph, which has, in a sense, explained how the following is possible, namely that all sensible intuitions stand under the categories as conditions under which alone their manifold can come together in one consciousness. Well, that's been explained if you look at paragraph 20 by saying the manifold is given in the sensible intuition necessarily belongs under the original synthetic unity of apperception, since through this alone is the unity of the intuition possible. Right? It has to fit under this self-consciousness, which is thereby necessary. But that action of the understanding, however, through which the manifold are given representations, whether they be intuitions or concepts, is brought under an apperception in general, is the logical function of judgments. Well, that is the logical function of judgments. Now, how do we get that? What are the missing links that allow him to say that the action whereby the manifold is brought under the unity of self-consciousness, but that is a logical function of judgment. What has to be added to support that claim? And he has been explaining. Well, it involves imposing a necessary combination. Judgment is precisely what provides a necessary combination, which is equally an objective combination. And so we can now characterize it as being the logical function of judgment. And therefore, he says, all manifold, insofar as it is given in one empirical intuition, is determined in regard to one of the logical functions for judgment, by means of which it is brought to a consciousness in general. No, he says to one of the logical functions of judgment, which leaves it open. Is it just, first of all, it leaves open how many there are. It leaves open whether it's enough that only one be at hand, as opposed to whether there can be more than one. If it's variable, how many can be, and you might wonder, again, what could that be contingent upon if we're dealing with something that really is to play this kind of necessary role with regard to thinking objects in general? Well, the categories are these very functions. Therefore, it might appear that we've already succeeded in finishing with the deduction of the categories. But he now remarks on the opposite page. He says, in the above proposition, therefore, the beginning of a deduction of the pure concepts of the understanding has been made, in which, since the categories arise independently from sensibility, merely in the understanding, I must abstract from the way in which the manifold for an empirical intuition is given, in order to attend only to the unity that is added to the intuition through the understanding by means of the category. So here, we're talking to a unity that is added to the intuition, sort of following this notion that we have, you know, the separate sensibility, and then the understanding thinks what is given through the sensibility, adding to it. Well, what does that still leave up in the air? Well, he says the following. In the sequel, section 26, it will be shown from the way in which the empirical intuition is given in sensibility, that its unity can be none other than the one the category prescribes to the manifold of a given intuition in general according to the preceding. Thus, by the explanation of its a priori validity in regard to all objects of our senses, the aims of the deduction will first be fully attained. So what is he suggesting is still lacking that needs to be accounted for? Where, okay, we've established this proviso that the functions of the understanding have to, in a sense, be applied to sensible intuitions in order for them to fit within self-awareness. Okay, we have that proviso, but what does that, in a certain sense, leave open?
How they apply?
Not only how they can't fly, but maybe they don't. Maybe they can't be applied. Right? Which may also be a question of how they can, you know, that there is a way of explaining how they apply. So now if we turn to 26, which is itself characterized as the transcendental deduction of the universe of possibilities as a pure concept of understanding and experience, we have somebody presented, again, extremely quickly. And he tells us, what is now going to be explained? Well, now the possibility, I'm reading sort of midway through the first paragraph, he says, now the possibility of cognizing a priori through categories, whatever objects may come before our senses, not as far as the form of their intuition, but rather as far as the laws of their combination are concerned. Okay, not as far as their form of intuition. The form of the intuition is what? Time, space and time. Time and space. But the laws of their combination are concerned. Thus, the possibility of, as it were, prescribing the law to nature, and even making the latter possible, is to be explained. Well, why has that possibility not yet been explained? What does it seem to be suggesting? We know that they have a certain form, right? The form of temporal and, in the case of outer intuition, spatial ordering. One might ask, well, is that going to be something that will fit the lawfulness of their combination? I mean, to some degree, that might be regarded as a question. Because if you look at what follows, well, the possibility of prescribing laws of nature, that is, getting these combinations to actually operate upon sensibility, pertains to the question of whether they can be formed in this way. Well, they have a certain kind of form. Is that form incompatible with this? Well, if you look at what he says, what follows, it focuses upon just that. About how space and time are themselves necessarily ordered by the unity of self-consciousness. So he writes, space and time are represented a priori not merely as forms of sensible intuition, but as intuitions themselves, which contain a manifold. And thus, with the determination of the unity of this manifold, right? Can't have a manifold unless it has a unity. It's not a manifold. Well, if they're intuitions, they have a manifold. Thus, even the unity of the synthesis of the manifold, outside and within us, hence also a combination with which everything that is to be represented is determined in space and time must be agreed, is already given a priori, along with, not in these intuitions, as conditions of the synthesis of all apprehension. Now he says not in, but along with. Why does he also say that? What's he getting at? It is already given. If it were given in, but not along with, what would that signify? That would not help us conclude the deduction. Well, it would mean that the manifold, the unity of the manifold, in the intuitions of space and time, the current intuition of space and time, was united independently of the unification achieved by the understanding in its way of, in a sense, subsuming sensible intuitions into the unity of self-consciousness. Rather, it's pointing to how the unity of the manifold has to come from without, has to be provided by the help of the understanding. So he says, but this synthetic unity can be none other than that of the combination of the manifold of a given intuition in general in an original consciousness. After all, this is another intuition. These pure intuitions are also intuitions. As intuitions, they're subject to the very same unification that every intuition is in order for it to fit within awareness. Consciousness Consequently, all synthesis, through which even perception itself becomes possible, stands under the categories. And since experience is cognition through connected perceptions, note experience is cognition through connected perceptions, is a connection which provides both experience and cognition, because it's that which allows them to be representations of something objective. Well, the categories are conditions of the possibility of experience and are thus also valid a priori of all objects of experience. Okay, so here this even applies to space and time themselves. And that necessity secures that there has to be this unification. It's not left hypothetical, where we don't know whether sensible intuition will really be able to fit, because we haven't yet established that what might appear to be a separate unity of forms of intuition are incompatible with the combinations being demanded. Now, in a sense, what is going to provide an explication in way of how this operates is the schematism. And you can see the problem that is raised, the problem that requires the schematism, that is some way in which we can show how the combinations affected by the understanding through the categories, the necessary combinations, ingredients in any awareness of objects, in any experience, can lay hold of sensible intuitions. We've seen that the only thing they can lay hold of is going to be something that is necessary to any sensible intuition. And yet it has to be something that can both be inherent in sensible intuitions and also have something about it that's inherent in concepts or conceptual unification. As Kant says, we have to find a third term, a third element that bridges the gap between them. Now, in a sense, from the very outset, we've known all along, the only thing that is really going to be operated upon or being the source of the objective character of sensible intuitions is going to be that which is necessarily common to them all, which is what? Time. So in a sense, we're going to be turning to time and to see how we can find time determinations that do two things, that in a sense exhibit the type of unification the categories each involve, and that insofar as their time determinations can apply to sensible intuition, because they are ordered in time. So in a sense, what the schematism is going to provide is, as Kant will say, not an image, which would once again be a particular representation, but rather, in a sense, a procedure for determining through time sensible representations in a way that exhibits these necessary forms of judgment or combinations. And so what you want to do is to look at the discussion of schematism, see how this is done. Alas, once again, we're just given the categories and then given the time determinations that fit each of them without yet a clear account of really what the categories are, why they are exhaustive in their number, why they have to be what they are. But at some point along the line, we'll be in a position to judge how these kind of time orderings with respect to sensible intuitions are or are not constitutive of whatever can be an object of experience. And we'll hopefully then be in a position to really deal in a juridical manner with the content of the categories. So look back on the schematism, and we'll be pushing beyond the schematism into the discussion of the principles, where Kant is going to speak about what these specific functions are, these types of combinations as they apply and order objects. And I think here the specifics will become something that finally is intelligible and something that we need to judge whether it's appropriate. Any questions? you have questions about the transcendental deduction or any parts of it, bring them up whenever. We're not necessarily leaving everything behind. That's what we need to think about.
Sense of sensation.